Music, among other things.
Music among other things.
Music among other things.
Hey everyone, I'm Sean.
And I'm Neil.
Welcome to Music Among Other Things, or MEOT for short, where we chat to musicians and creators about music and the worlds that orbit it. And today we've got a episode where we're going to be talking to the UK's number one Elvis tribute act, Gordon Hendrix. And we've got a long list of talking points with Gordon, which I think is going to be really interesting to get into. So things like how he first got into Elvis. He was also a contestant on Stars in the Rise back in the day. And also he's gone on to work with real Elvis collaborators as well. So I think there's going to be lots of really interesting stuff to get into there.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think, I don't know about you, but the thing that interests me most of these tribute acts or impersonators, which I don't actually know the correct PC term in calling them, so it'd be good to find that out. But the thing that I really want to know is how much they really take on the tribute. Do they become them, or is it just literally from 7 to 10 p.m. are they that person, and then they go off and they're Gordon again? Or do they live that life? Do you have to kind of take on that personality in your everyday life? That's what I kind of want to know. I think there's going to be a lot of picking Gordon's brain, really, because you and I are very similar with small details. So we know that he's entered all these all these competitions with loads of different Elvis impersonators, and just picturing a room full of different Elvises, like, I just want to know everything, you know, what's the banter between them, or what. So it's going to be an interesting one.
That's what I'm really interested in getting him, because I know they're huge communities as well, and I want to know what the sort of criteria is for a good Elvis, and whether they take pointers from each other. So yeah, there's going to be lots of that to get into, I think. And you're right as well, because you're dedicating your whole life, you know, traveling all around the world, going to these competitions, just performing as this one person, and that's obviously like a massive commitment and dedication. So yeah, you do wonder how deep it goes, and whether it ever sort of, you know, goes into their like real life and day to day as well. But have you seen many tribute acts yourself, Neil?
I have actually I've seen not loads. I've only actually seen two Beatles bands, I think, Beatles tributes. Latest one was in Liverpool a couple of years ago with my fiance Sophie. So we went quite early in our relationship to Liverpool, first time there, and we did a whole Beatles trip because we're like Beatles mad. Yeah. And yeah, we saw this cover band called Made in Liverpool in the actual Cavern Club, and it was honestly one of the best nights of our lives. It was just they were literally so accurate to the Beatles. Even to the looks, you know, Paul McCartney was a lefty on bass. All of them were just so at it. But then the one thing I remember, the key thing I remember, is Ringo Starr, who couldn't make it that night due to like a last minute illness or something. They just had like a random bald mate who had to fill in. So I'm sure he was like a professional standing, but he was just like a bald guy at the back on drums in like a white t-shirt when everyone else was in like their suits and proper like suited and booted as the Beatles. But so that's something that kind of makes us laugh thinking about it. But no, they were absolutely amazing. So I'd definitely kind of see them again.
That's awesome. Because also, it's quite a feat, actually, that none of the Beatles have gone bald. Well, it's like, I don't know what would have happened to Lennon over the years. Obviously, that is one of the highest questions regarding what John Lennon would have been doing.
What would have happened? I think he would have kept his hair thin strands, but it would have been lengthy still.
He would have worn a beret, or tastefully covered it or something. But it's like, Ringo looks incredible now. He's like 80-something.
He looks, in my opinion, sorry if you're listening, Ringo, which I very much doubt you are, he looks better than he ever did. I don't know how he's getting better of age. He's like the Benjamin Button of the music world. He looks great, Ringo.
And obviously, he must have had like some sort of dye or like work done, but it's not like, it's quite tastefully done. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Didn't you say, actually, in your, you were in the Ringo suite when you went on that
Liverpool trip. Yeah. So it's quite fitting. Yeah, it's actually quite fitting when I think back, because obviously the one Beatle, in inverted commas, that we didn't see was Ringo. But then because we were in the Ringo suite, we had this massive, massive painting overlooking the bed, and it was just Ringo kind of like deep in thought, just staring right at you just while you're sleeping. It's quite strange, but so he was there in spirit, I guess, even though the standing drummer had to suffice. But
great guy. It's like I've seen quite a few tribute bands over the years. I saw like a Rolling Stones one in maybe a couple of years back, and I think the lead singer was called Mick Jaguar. You know, they have all these like alternative names and stuff. And I did catch a bit of Elvana. I don't know if you ever heard of them, but they basically do, it's Elvis fronted Nirvana. So it's all Nirvana songs, but the guy sings it like Elvis, essentially.
Wow.
So I did catch them once at a festival, which was a good laugh.
Who would be your kind of tribute act, I guess, if you had to do one?
Who could I pull off? Maybe like Bob Dylan or something.
I think we've said this on a pod before, but I don't know what episode it was. But
we might have done, yeah. We might have talked about it when we talked about like the biopics who you could play.
Maybe.
Who would you be?
I think I said at the time, Psy, Gangnam Style.
Yeah.
It's the only verse I can do, but no, I don't know. I think Bruno Mars is maybe half Filipino, slightly, or something.
Actually,
so.
Yeah, on the topic of Bruno Mars, he was a Elvis impersonator, and there was a video of him when he was about 4 years old being interviewed by Jonathan Ross, and he sat on his dad's lap and he's dressed as Elvis and stuff.
What?
Yeah, it's a really weird clip. And
Bruno Mars.
Yeah, and he was in some film as well. Oh yeah, so yeah, he was in a film called Honeymoon in Vegas. So yeah, he was like, I think he was about 4 or 5 when he was in this. And there's like loads of clips of it online. It came out in 1992. But maybe I'll drop a clip to a link to the clip in the show notes and stuff. But
I didn't know that.
Yeah, James Caan, Nicolas Cage, Sarah Jessica Parker. It's a head of a lineup.
Yeah. So he's been in the limelight his whole life.
Yeah. No wonder he's like so natural in front of like millions of people at the Super Bowl and stuff. But
yeah, we've had very different lives. Maybe I wouldn't be Bruno then. Sigh it is.
Well, maybe we better get on with Gordon, mate. I think he's just about to come on. So yeah, let's get into it. What's going on the background there? There's some discs up on the wall and everything.
This is the room I do all my live feeds from in the UK.
Oh, amazing!
Looks incredible.
Yeah, so what I do is I bought this house about 12 months ago, and then I do all my live streams from here. So this is a separate building in my garden at the back of the house here. And what I do is it's like a bar. So it's like my own bar here. And so we've made it all like nice for live viewing.
It looks like a proper sophisticated man cave, that.
It's pretty cool, yeah. I've got to say, it is pretty cool. I'm pretty happy with it.
Love it.
Very nice. And you've been doing a lot of these live streams in lockdown, right? But on quite a regular basis.
Yeah, it started. Well, it started a year ago last week when I was asked to do a live stream. And I've got to tell you, live stream wasn't really my thing. I'm used to live audiences. I'm used to performing in front of live audiences. So to come on and sing in front of a camera is pretty daunting.
Very
to
odd.
Be fair.
Yeah.
Yeah, because there's no audience there and you're basically speaking to yourself. So I was asked to go on to raise some money for the National Health Service. So I decided to go on and do it, and something crazy happened. So I went on and we had nearly 1,800 viewers on the live stream.
Wow.
And I raised £17,000 on that night.
Incredible.
Which is just crazy stuff. So after that, I thought there was something in it, you know. So I decided to do a live stream every 2 weeks. And when I look back at my old live streams now, they're terrible. I look so nervous. I don't know what I'm doing. But I really got a hold of it. And now it became something really crazy happened. And Now they call these shows the G-Man shows, and it's like Saturday night at the G-Man house. and I've really kind of grown with it. You know, I've kind of made it my own now. And nobody gets the views I get. It's incredible. You know, last Saturday, we had over 1,200 people tuning in on Saturday night for a couple of hours.
Awesome.
Now, that's amazing that they beat you guys up. So it must be quite a lot of work to put into it as well, which is crazy. But yeah, thank you so much for coming on, Gordon. Sorry, we just jumped straight into it with the questions.
Absolutely.
There. Seamless transition. But yeah, thanks so much for coming on. We usually do a thing called Recently Added where we speak to people about what they've been listening to a lot of recently. I was thinking with you, we could do a sort of spin because obviously I imagine you have a very like good knowledge of the Elvis catalogue. I was wondering if there was a Elvis deep cut that not many people know but you think everybody should know about. Because I think I saw a show of yours on YouTube and you did a song called If You Talk In Your Sleep, and I hadn't actually heard that one before. I really enjoyed it. And yeah, just wondering if there's another track there that you might recommend.
There's so many songs. I mean, there's a couple of songs I really love. There's a little song that I absolutely fell in love with, and it was about, I'd say about, I don't know, over 10 years ago now. I went to Alabama and I worked with a guy called Cheryl Nielsen, who was one of Elvis's backing singers in the 70s. And there was a guy there, and he got on the stage and he sang this little blues song called Three Corn Patches. And I'd never heard it before. And we were in Alabama, and it's a southern song anyway about the cotton fields and all that. And he just sang this song. I thought, wow, I've never heard that song before. It kind of blew me away because it just got a real great feel to it. And there's an album that it's on, off the off cuts really that Elvis was doing at the time. And I just loved it. So then, I mean, another one's called Raised on Rock that I also love that song as well. But, you know, the thing is with the Elvis, I call it a family, like a big Elvis family. There's a lot of guys who only listen to the top 30 hits, you know, and in the Elvis world, there's so much more to listen to. You know, there's a lot of blues, rhythm and blues. And if I don't know if you've ever been to Beale Street in Memphis, I've been quite a few times, but you can really tell Elvis's influences from that kind of music. Not just commercial, you know, American Trilogy or Suspicious Minds or that kind of thing. But all you have to do is walk down to Beale Street and there's guys there to this day, and some of them are in the 80s and the 90s still sitting outside, you know, playing blues music. And, you know, that's where the influences came from. And then the commercial side comes to it with the Elvis music. But, you know, if you really delve hard enough, there's just magical stuff out there that people don't really recognize as Elvis music. You know, it's fascinating, really.
Totally. Because, it might be a good place to start with how you got into this thing in the first place. I think you just mentioned you came from a big Elvis family. And me and Neil were talking before whether with tribute act to a certain extent, whether it's like a chicken or egg situation, whether you sort of see some, you either like the person a lot and you want to explore their music, or whether you sort of see a similarity in the way you look or the way you can sing and you go about it that way. What was the sort of starting point for you?
Well, it certainly wasn't the way I look, because I'm the opposite of Elvis.
Got the blonde hair. Got the quiff.
Yeah,
so it certainly wasn't the way I look, but it was for me. I grew up in a family of 11 sisters, and I was the only male in that family. So you can imagine my life was hell when I was a kid. growing up with that. But to be fair, it was a good thing in a way because of music influences. So you know, they, I grew up with all genres of music, you know, country, rhythm and blues, rock and roll, everything, you know, because they all had different individuality of their music. So I grew up listening to that. So I absorbed a lot of music when I was a child, from like 3 or 4 years old. So from everything but opera right through to the Elvis stuff. But there was a couple of my sisters who really loved Elvis, and they used to just play it every single day. And I remember just being absorbed by it. And I didn't really watch the TV at that point, but it was just something that I listened to. And I remember a box set being brought in, and I just fell in love with it. I don't know what it was with the Elvis stuff. I just kind of connected to it.
Yeah.
And it was a strange experience, really, because I believed that when I was about 7 or 8 years old, that nobody knew who Elvis was except for me. It was just, I found this new thing.
Yeah.
And then I just took it from there, really. And I spent a lot of time in my room, you know, listening and just trying to, you know, hear everything in the records, you know, at that time. There was no CD player. It was just record vinyl. And I've still got all my vinyls to this day because of that. But I just loved the feel of the music. It was different, you know. It had a different feel to it. And that's what I wanted to do. And I remember I just wanted to do that. You know, that was all I wanted. And a funny story that I'd said a couple of weeks ago on a live stream, it's true. I grew up in a place called Kitchgrove, and we lived in like a cul-de-sac, like a bull ring.
Yeah.
All the kids used to play in the street playing football, and they all wanted to be footballers. They wanted to be famous footballers.
Yeah.
And all my cousins used to say, "We're going to be famous footballers." And they were really good, and they were going on trials and all this. And they used to say to me, "What do you want to do?" And I said, "I want to be Elvis." And they used to laugh at me, think I was going crazy. And and now the funny thing is that they all queue up and pay to come and see me as Elvis. They're all in factories and doing their stuff.
You're the only person that made it.
That's right.
So what was the sort of maybe the first time you performed any Elvis songs? Was it like Gunsand? It was sort of like karaoke and then you went on to like Stars in Our Eyes and things of that nature. When was like the first time? What was the transition from there to getting involved in competitions and things of that nature?
Well, you know, I didn't really realize there was this Elvis world out there. I've got to be really honest with you. For me, it was a personal connection to the music. So I didn't think that there was other guys doing it. You know, I didn't think that they were doing it. So I just grew up and was continued listening to it. And my story is a bit like the Elvis story because I used to have a barbershop.
Right.
And I opened this little barbershop up and I just loved memorabilia, like pictures and albums and stuff. So I opened this little shop up in a town centre in Burslem at the time.
Mm.
And I was only 18 when I had my first business. So I'd cut hair and I'd put all my albums all over the walls. And it got attention from people. So customers would walk past and they would give me, they'd call in, "I've got this album, do you want it?" I'd say, "Yeah, that's great." And I'd put it on the wall.
Nice.
And then it grew and grew and grew and grew. And then people said to me, "You know, you should sing. You should do some singing." Well, I always sang from like 3 or 4 years old, but I was really shy and thought, "No, you know, I'm not going to do that." But then one afternoon, I closed the shop and I went down to this little recording studio who was local, and I just wanted to record to see what I sounded like, if I sounded like Elvis. So I went down and recorded this little single, and then I used to play it in the shop, and I left it on one day. And this customer walked in and said, "Oh, I love Elvis."
Wow. Yeah.
I said, "What?" I said, that's me singing. And then they say, "What, you do that? You sound like that." And I said, "Yeah, that's me. You should do it.
Yeah.
So that's how it started. Then people said to me, "You should go into karaoke competitions or you should sing in pubs and stuff." And that's how it all started for me, really, from that really early stage.
I mean, I'm really fascinated with the whole Elvis tribute community because, like you said, you didn't realize it was out there, and I'm sort of curious to see how those competitions work. And am I right in saying the ultimate Elvis artist champion in Memphis, that's like the grail of the competitions, is that right? Because there's a lot of them out there, right?
That's the one that everybody wants.
When I
started in the business, I was doing the little pubs and the clubs, you know, I was getting like £50 for a gig. And I used to have this little Fiat Punto. And I used to put all my speakers in the back of it. And used to go to the pubs and set up my equipment and have about 200 people in this pub with the backs to you talking and laughing and joking and drinking. And you'd be singing in a corner.
Yeah.
And then pick up £50 for the night and you'd have to pack up your stuff and then travel back home and then go the next night and do it again.
Mm.
And that was basically my life for like 6 months.
Wow.
And then, I've worked everything, you know, I've done right round from the bottom to the top. So, there was this program called Stars in Their Eyes, and I used to watch it when I was a kid. I used to be fascinated by people coming out of the doors with the smoke, and they just change like that. I want to do that. So I contacted them, and I went down. It was a bit like the X Factor of today at the time, because it was a prime time TV show. It was a Saturday night. And you know, you used to watch your favorite stars on there, and that's what something I really wanted to do, just to say that I'd done it. So I applied. I went down to Granada Studios, and we went for an interview, and it was like a panel of four judges in this room, and you walked in, and you just sang. There was no music; you just had to sing to the four people, and then they would write down and say, "Okay, we'll be back in touch with you." So that's basically what happened. I went down and did it, and then they got back in touch with me. And then they said, okay, so the next stage now is we're going to contact you. And then if we contact you, then you've made the TV.
Right, yeah.
Oh, great. So I remember doing this. I'd broken my leg, actually, right, because it was about 2 months after. So I remember in the house, and I've got this cast on my leg, full cast, and I get a phone call. Can you come back down to Granada Studios to do us another audition? I was like, yeah, I'll be there. So my friend took me, and I got out the car on the crutches and I was stumbling in, and they looked at me like I'd lost my mind, and I said, I broke my leg, and they said, well, you've made TV, what are you going to do? I said, I don't know. So I had to wait until that came off,
right,
and then got on the TV, and it was great. It was the most amazing experience, you know, to be on TV, and it was fabulous. And I remember going out on the episode, and it was a pre-recorded episode. It wasn't live. Mm. And I didn't win the episode. A guy who sang Phil Collins won the first episode.
Right. Yeah.
It was an audience where they pressed a buzzer in the old days, and you got the vote.
And it
was an audience full of like students that they just invite in for the studio audience. Mm. So I kind of knew that nothing was going to happen for me, because they didn't even know who Elvis was, you know. So I went on my merry way, and that was it. But what happened was, they were doing 10 episodes over, I think it was 10 weeks. Mm. And after every episode, they'd have a live call-in, and you could vote for your favorite of the whole production.
Right, yeah, so, yeah.
I didn't think about it. So I went back and got on with my own life. And then I got the call that I'd been chosen to go back as the wild card
from
the nation.
Wow.
So I was like, okay. So then they came, they collected me, they took me down to Granada Studios that night, and I went live and ended up winning the whole thing, which is incredible.
That's incredible. That's incredible. Yeah.
Yeah. It changed my life completely, because then opened, all these doors started to open, you know. Yeah. I mean, in the audience that night, there was a guy called Jeff Morrow, and he wrote songs for Elvis, and he was in the audience that night, and when I won, he contacted me and said the hairs on the back of my neck stood up. He'd been in the recording studio with Elvis himself personally and recorded songs with him. He said, I want you to come to London, and I want you to finish off a song I gave to Elvis called Where Would I Be? I wrote it for him in 1976. I said, okay.
Wow.
So I went down to London and recorded the whole song and finished the song off. And that, you know, I just thought it was an incredible thing to do.
That must have been pretty emotional, like such an honor sort of thing. I mean, you could have never saw that coming, that you're actually going to finish that kind of, that's incredible.
When I did the recording, I remember going to his house, and he wrote some amazing songs for amazing people. Mm. And I walked into his house in London, and there's just gold discs everywhere. And I thought, wait a minute, you know, 2 weeks ago, I'm in the local pub singing to 50 people.
Yeah.
And now I'm here. And he said, I've never heard anybody sound so much like Elvis than you. He said, it must be born into you, because you've just got that tone, that everything that belongs to that voice.
Yeah.
And I said, okay. And he sat on the piano and he played the song for me, and I could actually hear the essence of Elvis in it, you know, straight away. I thought, without a doubt, it definitely wrote for him. And he wrote also for Barry Manilow, and he wrote the massive worldwide hit, I Can't Smile Without You. And the wow. gold disc was on the wall. I was like, wow, that's incredible. So I was in good company. So when I recorded the song, it was something really special, and I hold it pretty close to my heart. Then.
And then, I mean, I take it after that, that would be when you maybe started getting involved in more of the Elvis competitions, which, as I understand, are massive events that happen all over the world, really. I was sort of wondering what the sort of criteria and process is for that. Is there like a judging panel? Is there like a specific criteria, or does that sort of vary between the different festivals?
Yeah, I mean, after the Stars in Their Eyes program was done, I was kind of thinking, well, what now? You know, what do I do now? Because it wasn't like the X Factor in the way of they give you £1 million and you just set for life.
Yeah.
You know, that's when your career starts. You know, that's a starting block. So I didn't know what to do, which avenue to go to. I actually went back and started cutting hair again and my barbers, and life was just back to normal. The problem with it was you did become a little bit famous. Yeah. And with that, people started to come to the shop and you know, I had the fame, but I didn't have the money. Nothing then. It was just incredible. You were just left out in the cold on your own, which was pretty scary stuff.
Mm. Yeah.
When you've been on TV, people recognize you, and that's it. So I thought, what am I going to do? So I had to close down my shop and go on the road. You know, it changed my life. I had to go and get back on the road, which we did. And then the only way to make it in the Elvis business is to compete.
Mm.
And I never really competed. So I decided to go to the Birmingham Hilton.
Mm-hmm.
And it was to find the European champion. So I entered and I went out to Birmingham, and people had flown in from all over Europe. And there's a panel of judges. And I went down and competed, and I won the European Championship in 2011. So that I had that one that was under my belt, and I thought, okay, what now? What do I do now? And in the Elvis world, I found out that what you have to do is keep competing until you get the world title.
Yeah.
And it is like, it's just the crazy world, man. You just going and traveling and competing and getting your face around in America and in Canada, and Australia, everywhere, all over the world, and competing so people can get used to you. I've been really lucky in the way of there's guys that I know now that have been in competitions and they've been doing it for years and they keep going back. And every year they go and they'll get fifth place, and then the year they'll go fourth, or and they'll get third, or they'll get a second, or they'll get back to third, or they'll get standing on that stage, and I've watched them through my whole career.
Yeah.
I thought, I don't really want to put myself through that. So I've been really lucky. Every competition I've entered, I've always had first place, which I've never had a second, never had a third. So I've been really lucky. So the competitions I've entered, I've won them all.
Mm.
And so my room is full of these trophies up here because of that. But I'm pretty proud of that because I didn't have to have that heartache, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, totally. And,
so when I went for the world title in Memphis, 2017, it was a crazy year. I never actually believed I was going to win that because it was the 40th anniversary of the passing of Al. So it was the biggest year ever in Memphis. 75,000 people turned up, and the Presley family were there too.
Wow.
You know, I think I was the second English guy in there, and there was like 20 competing.
Yeah.
And there were, you know, the Americans, the Canadians, Australians, all over the world. And I thought, well, am I going to do this? Because they picked the best out of a bunch of people.
Yeah.
So if you're European champion, though, you can go.
Mm. Yeah.
To compete. So they were all
best of the best.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So when we got there to Memphis, I just got on with it. I went to my manager and I mean, this is how English I am. I sat backstage in Memphis drinking tea. While everybody was, you know, getting excited and thinking they're going to win the world title. I didn't even think I was going to win it. I just thought I'll just go and have a cup of tea.
Yeah.
And then I'll just and enjoy it. And that's what I did. And I kept getting through. I kept getting through these heats, and I couldn't understand why.
Yeah.
And there was two judges there called the Holiday Sisters who were backing singers for Elvis. And they're the Memphis recordings, Suspicious Minds. So if you listen to Suspicious Minds, and the backing singers were the Holiday Sisters.
Wow.
So they were my judges. And I had an interview with them the night before the final. And I walked into the room and they stood up and they said, "You're the one we remember." And I said, "Okay." And I said, "Why is that?" And they said, "Because your sound is just unbelievable."
Yeah.
I was like, "Oh, thank you." And I went out to the final and sang the final song, and that was it. I became world number one. And I was, what comes with that is you get endorsed by Graceland. So I'm officially endorsed by Graceland Memphis. And it just gives you nice privileges, you know. Like, I can use certain things that other guys can't. And it's nice. Yeah. It's nice.
Does it, like, with these competitions, I don't know if it's a stupid question, is it solely judging based on your voice, or is it your whole kind of persona, act, how you perform on stage? You know what I mean? Like, X Factor, we've had winners that haven't always had, you know, the best voice. But with this, I imagine a voice obviously takes the most important role. But is it also the whole performance?
It's everything, you know.
Yeah.
It's absolutely everything. It's right down to things like this. It's down to the costume that Elvis wore at that specific time on the song.
Wow.
The jewelry that went with that costume, the jewelry.
Okay. So you got to know your shit as well, like historically.
You've got to know everything. Mm. And it's not only that, it's the whole persona of Elvis on stage, the way he walked, the way he pronounced a word.
Wow.
I mean, it's crucial. You know, it is crucial. And if you slip up on anything, then you know they mark you down and you're gone. And it's that hard. It is hard. I mean, I do think that fate really worked its magic with me on that particular, especially for the 40th anniversary. I mean, you know, to win that is special. You know, so because I'm English, I never thought they were going to give it to an Englishman.
Yeah, I can't imagine there's been too many European winners of that.
It's mainly Americans, that they're mainly Americans who win it.
This
always makes me laugh. So they cut you down to five, so you go down to the last five, and then we're all backstage, and you know, sometimes people can be dramatic, right? So I mean, it's a big thing, right? This is a big thing, and I know it's a big thing, and I knew it, but I was really calm. And you know, when you're going out to thousands and thousands of people, it's nerve-wracking. But the guys backstage, they're praying and praise the Lord and praise God above. Come on, man. And all this, you know. And I'm sitting there drinking Yorkshire tea. I thought, well, this makes no sense. But it did at the end.
Yeah. So they're not judging you backstage, thankfully.
That's brilliant. And what, in terms of like your you know, peers that are maybe competing as well, is it quite a friendly atmosphere, or can it be quite, is it quite fiercely competitive? Like, what's sort of like, can you exchange notes with other Elvis impersonators?
Look, I think with any competition, it's a competition.
Yeah.
And you know, you can be friends with people, but ultimately, you know, you're there to win it. And you know, we all knew that. So there was a, you know, nobody was horrible or anything. It was a nice atmosphere to be in, but it was very tense too.
Yeah.
The atmosphere was, every time somebody got knocked out, or, you know, five people would go, you could see the devastation in these guys' faces. I mean, you've got to remember this, you know, they'd worked and worked so hard, you know, on their appearance, on their costumes. And these costumes, they don't come cheap. I mean, they're about £4,000 or £5,000 each.
Wow, right.
And you've got to, you know, you feel deflated when you're taken out, you know. So, you know, I do feel for that. I mean, it's no fun, you know, and the atmosphere backstage is pretty intense. You know, I've seen guys cry, I've seen people break down, you know, and all that, because it means so much to them, which is it's a passion. It's a passion for what they do.
Definitely. What's your, because I imagine you must have some really great Elvis inspired costumes as well. What's your sort of prized Elvis, either costume or piece of memorabilia or something you own? Have you got anything like that?
I own an original Elvis shirt.
Oh wow!
That he wore. And I'll show you. Wait there. I'll show you.
Oh yeah, go for it.
This is from 1957, I think. 56, 57.
Oh, wow.
Nice. That like very velvet. Nice.
Yeah, it's like a velvet. It's like the puffed sleeves on it. Stuff.
Nice. That looks wow. awesome.
Yeah, but it, I mean, it smells really old. But it's it was on a TV show, this, with the Jordanaires. So... So I've got some great memorabilia, but amazing. That's like one of my favorite things.
That's awesome.
But costume wise, I used a guy in America because I wanted to have the most authentic costumes. Yeah. I just think it's really important.
Yeah.
So I mean, my collection now is probably there's probably about 15 suits now wow. in the collection that I've got, and. You know, they range from anything from $2,000 to $3,000 to £5,000 to £6,000 each, wow. and they're just incredible. I mean, I have them made by Bill Ballou, who was the original designer for Elvis's costumes in America.
Right. Oh wow. Yeah.
And so they're identical. So if you go to Graceland and see the costumes of Elvis, you can't tell the difference between my costumes and the ones that are in Graceland. They just wow. look identical. It's incredible.
Wow.
The workmanship.
And you said you've also met quite a few people over the years who, yeah, either wrote for Elvis or performed with him. Have you heard any, like, cool stories about Elvis through those people or anything that they recall to you that particularly sticks with you?
Yeah, well, I've worked with Elvis's band, the original band members. And wow. I remember working with... The Sweet Inspirations, Elvis's backing group. And I did a 5-night tour with them.
Wow.
And I was so nervous about meeting them. And okay. when I went down to Bolton and they were rehearsing on stage, and DJ Fontana, who was Elvis's drummer in 1956 and was on the road with Elvis in 56, was on the gig too. he was on the drums, so he was playing the drums. And I remember going in and going to the sound check, and you've got to remember from my side of things, I was really kind of new on the circuit at this point. So these were like the Beatles to me. It's incredible. I've got to meet these people. So I was shaking like a leaf, and I actually smashed my car up.
oh, really? To the gig.
I was so nervous about meeting them.
Oh wow!
And because when I'm the DVDs or the videos I used to watch years ago, I'd see Elvis with, you know, the Sweet Inspirations, and he'd call over and he'd say, the Sweet Inspirations, and they'd be there. And, you know, and DJ Fontana was on the Ed Sullivan Show with Elvis, you know, sitting behind Elvis playing the drums, you know, and he was there building. So I'd gone in and had to do a sound check with him, and I just shaking like a leaf. I just couldn't believe what I was doing. It was just incredible.
Yeah.
But I remember getting on the stage and meeting him, and they just really made me feel so welcome, and they were just nice people, you know, and that's, I only like nice people. and they were just really nice people, lovely people. And Myrna, who passed away 4 or 5 years ago now, she came up to me and I was doing sound check, and she said to me, "Baby, where'd you get that voice from?" That's it. I said, "I don't know. It just happened. It just happened." She goes, "You got soul, baby. That's right." I love it. I love that conversation.
Yeah.
And afterwards, we did the show, and I remember singing "If I Can Dream," which is such a big iconic song for Elvis in '68.
Yeah.
And they were singing with me, and I looked over, and I had DJ Fontana behind me playing the drums, and the Sweet Inspiration singing harmony with me, and I was just in heaven. I just couldn't believe it.
Pinch yourself, pinch yourself moment.
And after the gig, we all went and they sat around this pub and they were drinking pints of lager. Right? It was incredible.
Yeah.
And they were just telling me stories about how Elvis was after shows, and you know, people have got this perception that he was up all night and, you know, rocking and rolling and partying.
Mm.
And she goes, he would be up all night, but he would be singing gospel music.
Right. And wow.
It was very calm.
Yeah.
It was very, very calm and very spiritual after a show.
Mm.
And I asked her loads of questions, obviously I'm going to, and I said, you know, what was it like when you were doing Hello, Ha from Hawaii? You know, it was the first satellite TV show around the world. Over 1 billion people saw it.
Yeah.
And she said, this is what I loved. She said, when Elvis was in Vegas doing his shows, she said, he was just Elvis doing his shows. But when the cameras were on, he was Elvis Presley.
Yeah.
And I was like, really? She said, oh, man. She said, he turned it on for them cameras. She says, but if the cameras weren't on, he was just Elvis.
Mm.
And I love that. I thought it was a great story.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, that's incredible that, you know, you got to that stage where you're playing with the original band. I mean, it's, I sort of thinking, you know, I guess at this stage, you got your own, you know, real fan base. Like you say, that you got thousands of people tuning into your live streams every week. So what do you think you'll, you know, what's the sort of next stage, if there is one, or is it just the fact that you've got this community now and you can literally do what you want with it? I mean, will you go and compete again? I guess it's not too much point if you've already, you know, got the sort of biggest achievement in the Elvis community.
Well, when you win the ultimate, you're not allowed to compete.
Oh,
again.
Really?
Okay. Oh, right. Okay.
Yeah, because it would be unfair because of the prize monies. So,
yeah.
You're not allowed. So you're classed as an ultimate then.
Mm.
So you've got a box. That's why everybody wants it, because there's only a certain amount in the world. I mean, you can imagine how many Elvis impersonators or Elvis tribute artists, if you want to call it, whatever you want to call them, in the world today. There's millions and millions. Mm. But there's only a limited amount who have won the ultimate. I think there's 13 in the whole world now.
Wow, yeah.
Who've made the ultimate, who's won the ultimate. So to be English and hold that title for me is really special. And I don't think it would be good for me to compete again like any other Elvis tribute artist who've won the ultimate, because, like you say, you know, once you've won that, then there's nowhere for you to go.
Yeah, you can't top that, can you?
So you've done that. So now it's just, you know, enjoying your career. And that's exactly what I'm doing.
Yeah.
And what it's done for me is it's given me more confidence in my ability and what I can do myself. So I've gone into now songwriting, and
incredible.
We've got some songs down, but we're going to record some original stuff. And I went to Nashville and recorded a whole country album.
Wow.
And that was just fabulous. And what also now it's opened up doors for me to do other stuff. Mm. And the lockdown situation has really, really helped me in my career and my popularity too, because you know, you can sit in a box where people go, okay, so he's Elvis now and that's it.
Mm.
Right. And what it's done for me is it's exposed me to people that think he does other stuff too. You know,
yeah,
totally. He is dressed as Elvis and he's got no costume on. And that's what I can't get my head around, the popularity for that. Mm. When I do a live stream from here, I have never once dressed as Elvis in here. I've been me and just my voice.
Mm-hmm.
And my personality's come across and people have got to know me for who I am.
Yeah.
And they love it, you know, and it's been great. It's been fantastic.
What are some of the other, you say you're starting to songwrite yourself. What are some of the other inspirations you have other than likes of Elvis? I imagine is always going to be inspired by you, but what are some of your other inspirations? Is it kind of all from that time or is it more modern day artists as well, or quite a spread?
Yeah, well, I mean, when I grew up, I listened to everything, you know, so a lot of country, a lot of soul, a lot of rhythm and blues. Mm. I love a lot of Motown stuff, and I love all different types of music. I mean, I'm in the middle of recording a new album called Saturday Night at the G House.
Awesome.
And it's all non-Elvis stuff.
Yeah.
I'm doing a Bruce Springsteen song.
Oh, awesome.
And just different spins on stuff, that's what I'm doing. But I love the acoustic and just piano and guitar.
Have you got any live shows on the horizon at the moment, or are you keeping to the live stream? Have you booked anything like in the real world, shall we say?
The real, what's the real world? This is the real world now, isn't it?
I know.
Yeah, I mean, things have started opening up now for us. I mean, as you can imagine, I am very, very busy. I did a national tour of Australia just before the lockdown. We did 18 concerts over 5 weeks, and it was all across Australia. So every show we did, we were flying 5 hours to the next show, 5 hours to the next show, and we were taking a whole 22-piece band with us as well. So it was it was hectic. And I've just signed a deal for January, February this year coming as well to do the tour again. So what my manager's done basically has been moving things around. Because we just can't get into the theatres. I mean, you know yourself, in the entertainment business, it's probably going to be the hard hit because, you know, there's no way you can kind of do this social distancing if you're in a theatre. It's just impossible, you know. So if you've got a 1,000-seater, you're going to get half capacity in there, which financially is a nightmare for you. And it's not going to work. So what we decided to do was to bring live stream into the shows as well. So we're going to do both. We're going to bring people in and we're going to live stream it out.
Oh, that's great. Idea.
That's the only way to do it, to kind of financially make it work. So I start back on stage, I think it's June, and then I'm really, really busy after that, right the way through till next year because of, I mean, I judge a competition as well in Canada called Flaming Star. So I'm off there in October to be a judge on judging panel to Elvis convention, which is great. And then I'm off to Australia in the January. But the funny thing that's happened is the G-Man shows, like the ones I do here in here, we were asked for me to go down and do a G-Man show. So I said, yeah, of course I'll do it. So it went on sale, and then in 28 minutes it was gone. The whole thing had sold out. Which is incredible, which makes me feel more nervous because I think to myself, it's all right, you know, singing in here, but when you've got to face people, you know, then it's different, isn't it? And when you're in the costume, you're in like, you're in character.
Yeah, I was gonna say actually, does it, because I imagine when you're in a costume and, you know, impersonating Elvis, it's, you almost, because you're acting like him and have his persona, you've got this newly found confidence, haven't you? Because you're adrenaline as well, whereas, like you say, it's similar to what you were talking about earlier, stripped, it's almost you as well. You're just now stripped back without the mask, so to speak, and it's probably quite scary. You probably feel like a child again sometimes, but
like before. Yeah, it's true, scary stuff, because people, they want to see you as Elvis, right? So you do that, and that's great. But, you know, I kind of do prefer, I shouldn't say this is like sacrilege, but I kind of do prefer the other side too, because it gives me more freedom in the music. You know, I can do my own original stuff, and, you know, and it gives me more versatility, that, because there's only so far you can go with the Elvis stuff, right? So doing your own stuff, you can do whatever you want to do, which is great. You know, that's what I want to do, really. So to answer your question, is what's going to happen in the future for me is, now the doors are open, you know, because this lockdown situation has really opened them doors for people, for me to see me for the first time.
Yeah.
And now they want to see me on stage doing this, which is great. And, you know, in the ETA world, it's very rare that ETAs have done that. I can't think of anybody who's crossed over, if you like, from the Elvis world into their normal world, you know, into what they want to do. So I think I'm kind of one of the first to do that, which is, it's great, you know. And that's why I was so nervous when I came on the live streams, because I was exposing myself to, for, you know, to me. And I thought, my God, are they going to like me?
Yeah.
You know, are they going to have to go? I mean, there are a lot of guys, I mean, people do make me laugh. I mean, I do love people.
Yeah.
But they also make me laugh. And when I go on, the comments come up. The first time I did a live stream, this comment come up: "Is this the warm up guy? When's Elvis coming on?" Like, Didn't know it was me. I was like, it's me.
It must be quite nice as well at the same time to almost have that fear again and that vulnerability, because you must, like, because you've won every award, it must be quite nice to be like, actually, it's been a while since I've had this, you know, this vulnerability feeling. Like, it must be quite nice in a way to actually feel that again.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's given me it's like a breath of fresh air for me, you know. To come in here and to perform, and it's a strange experience. I mean, I've had so much fun on the way, though. The memories I've got are just amazing, you know. I mean, when you go on the screen, you can see all these people coming in the room. So before I even show my face on the screen, there's probably 800-900 people sitting there waiting. And they're waiting for you to come out and speak and say hello, hello, hello. And then the comments start. And I do get a lot of pleasure from them, because they do make me laugh. And, you know, a lot of people, you know, they put up there, and, you know, this one guy said, he looks nothing like Elvis.
Always going to happen, isn't it?
Yeah. But you sound like him. And then some guy's going to, I don't know who you are, but hey, you're good at this. You can make a few quid out of this.
Yeah. I have no idea.
So there's that, you know, and I've enjoyed it. I've got to tell you, I've enjoyed it. And, you know, when I've had some sad times, you know, during this lockdown period, you know, where I've still had to come out and perform, and I've lost friends of mine through the COVID, and it's been tough, you know. But I do think if you're a music lover, music gets you through a lot of crappy times, you know. And
Definitely.
And it does help you. It's helped me. This has helped me a lot.
Definitely.
So now it's time for me to, you know, get back on the stage and do what I've got to do. But I do think it's the love and from everybody who's come along this last 12 months is just, it's really grown. I mean, I get messages now and gifts. Oh my God,
yeah.
The gifts I've got, incredible. I get gifts sent to the barbershop that I own, all my staff run that now. And I mean, I've been there today, and every day I turn up, there's gifts, you know, there's stuff from all over the world. Coming in all the time, and it's just incredible. My back of my shop is just full. One thing is, when I retire, I'm going to have the biggest car boot sale ever.
Keep an eye out for that, definitely. Well, it seems like we're going to have to tune into the G-Man show at some point, Neil. Definitely,
yes,
got to,
definitely
got to jump on that. But Gordon, thank you so much for your time. Been real fun chatting to you and getting into the Elvis community and everything.
Thank you for having me. Thank you.
So there we have it. A great conversation with Gordon there. So much detail and so much stuff to get into there. It's, I mean, he really has lived sort of the best tribute act life, really, because he's been able to work with people who actually worked with Elvis himself. And yeah, it's crazy what he's been able to do with it.
It is. And I guess it just shows that intense rivalry side of it as well, because, like, you know, when he was talking about the different competitions in Memphis, it sounds brutal, like that kind of life, you know. If you are one of the guys that can't quite hack it or can't quite cut it, and you're getting knocked out in the quarterfinals or whatever, you can't quite make it to the next round, it sounds absolutely brutal having to go through that every year. But
yeah
I mean, thankfully for Gordon, that, you know, we're speaking to Gordon, because he's the one who's just done it all, won it all.
Yeah,
but he could easily, I guess anyone could easily be that other person. So it's an absolute brutal world. So it's one of those, when you think of tribute acts and impersonators, I think there's a certain stigma attached to it sometimes, but that really kind of opened my eyes about how intense and serious it is as well.
Yeah, amazing talking to Gordon, I think. Really good chat there. And yeah, it certainly opened our eyes up to the tribute world and made us appreciate it much more, I think. So definitely going to try and tune into one of his live streams, or even try and catch him on tour at some point. Be great, I think. Cool. All right, Neil. Well, we'll catch up next time, and see y'all later.
Toodaloo!